The Spectator magazine combines incisive political analysis with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online, plus a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to Spectator Out Loud. Every week, a few of our favourite writers read out their articles in the latest issue. This week, we're going to be hearing from Richard Dobbs, who writes about why he's considering cancelling his second COVID jab if other places need it more. Tanya Gold writes about her British road trip in a Ferrari. And finally, Rory Sutherland on the unexpected pluses of lockdown and why we might miss it when it's gone. First up, it's Richard Dobbs.
I'm considering cancelling my second COVID vaccination. I received my first jab in March, and at the time I happily booked the date for the second one in June, confident that by then we would be continuing to see a fall in infections. But last week the story changed. The variant first identified in India could, according to Sage Minutes, be 50% more transmissible than the variant first identified in Kent. Early numbers suggest we could be at the start of an exponential growth in infections. The lessons of the past year is that if you wait until you're certain of the data, you're too late in changing your plans. Here, therefore, are four areas to consider now. First, in the race between vaccines and the virus, we are still constrained by supply. So wouldn't it be better if people like me, who have already had COVID, cancelled our second jabs and waited for the planned autumn booster, therefore allowing others to have their first shot instead? Second, while infections were very low, it made sense not to use the AstraZeneca shot for the under 30s. But now this decision might need revisiting if infections rise. Third, should we tighten up restrictions for those travelling from amber countries such as France, where 10% of the infections in Paris are from the more vaccine-busting South African variant? And finally, would face masks in schools now make sense? So let's illustrate how the Indian variant might have shifted the balance by looking at the first of these. The science in our understanding of vaccines is evolving, but recent US research has shown that those of us who suffered from COVID last year are at least as strongly protected after one jab as those who have not suffered from COVID are after two vaccine shots. The second jab seems less vital for those who've had COVID. So what would be the impact of giving up my second shot and waiting about 16 weeks for the booster? Let's look at some rough numbers. In spring last year, a 55-year-old had roughly a 200 in a million chance of dying from COVID in a 16-week period, according to research by David Spiegelhalter. These numbers will have improved given lower infection rates and better treatments, but they're good enough for rough estimates. Research suggests that the level of immunity after two doses of the vaccine reduces the risk of death by a factor of around 30. So we can guess that for anyone who's had the bug and one jab, it's roughly the same, working out a death rate of 7 in a million in any 16-week period for a 55-year-old. To put this number in context, it's roughly the same risk as a scuba dive or driving 1,700 miles. Now let's compare this death rate for a 35-year-old, the age range that would benefit if I gave up my dose. Unvaccinated, the chance of death is roughly 30 in a million in a 16-week period. A single dose of the vaccine reduces the death rate by around 80%. So that would mean a reduction in the likelihood of death of around 24 in a million in a 16-week period. That's more than three times more deaths avoided if those who have had COVID give up their second jab. And that's an underestimate, as it assumes the second jab would give those people total immunity. Then there are deaths avoided by reducing transmission. Despite the success of the overall vaccination program, there are still more than 2 million of the at-risk 50 plus age group who have not been vaccinated. This problem is more acute among some ethnic groups, according to NHS data, with more than 30% of black over 50s still unvaccinated. At current progress, it's going to take more than a year to vaccinate the higher risk over 70s, Black or South Asians, according to data from Oxford University's Open Safely analytics platform. Though the health secretary has said that the uptake has now increased. The higher transmission from the Indian variant will eventually cause more deaths as the virus finds the at-risk individuals who have so far not taken up the vaccination, as we are already seeing in Bolton. Vaccinating a greater proportion of the population with first doses would reduce overall transmission, giving us time to encourage the take-up amongst the hesitant. In the UK, I estimate between 10 and 15 million of us have had COVID. That number, incidentally, is much larger than the 4.5 million on the government's website, as the government's figure only includes those who have tested positive for COVID. Currently, we're administering around 400,000 second doses a day. If half of those who have had COVID postponed their second jab, that would free up roughly 40,000 doses a day, allowing a 20% increase in first dose vaccination. This would be enough to vaccinate in the next month all those that are still unvaccinated who are likely to act as spreaders, such as the police, teachers, firefighters, railway staff, posties, checkout staff and delivery workers. Now, I realise the communications could be complicated and it could cause confusion among the vaccine hesitant. Eleanor Riley, Professor of Immunology and Infectious Disease at the University of Edinburgh, captured the challenge when she said, prior to the rise of the Indian variant, that while people who have had COVID may require only one dose of the vaccine, incorporating this into max vaccination programme may be logistically complex and it may be safer overall to ensure that everyone gets two. But the rise of the Indian variant might have changed the balance here. Indeed, we could use those giving up their second jabs as part of the campaign for the unvaccinated to take up the vaccine. And isn't our whole approach to unlocking meant to be around personal judgment on the balance of risk? We have the power to decide who we should hug, how far apart we should sit, and whether to meet inside or outside. Why shouldn't this judgment not extend to whether I should take the risk of delaying my second jab for the good of society? So Boris Johnson, Matt Hancock, Patrick Vallance and Chris Switty, as you requested, I am now ready to take personal responsibility in the next phase of our response to COVID. I need to know from you if my maths is right. And if it is, I'd like others who have COVID and one jab to consider joining me in giving up our second jab for the greater good.
That was Richard Dobbs. And now, Tanya Gold.
Before pandemic, I thought I might drive across America or even France. So what about Kent, the Garden of England? Why treat English Heritage and the National Trust like guardians of the graveyard? You must be old or possessing a dog to enter. I need a car, and so I borrow a Ferrari. The car and I are both nervous. It has a peculiar consciousness. No car feels as responsive or as human. It feels like driving an Italian man. It is infinitely stylish. It beeps when it is anxious or cross, and it is credulous and ambitious about London traffic, which is touching. How can it take an hour to go 8 miles? Me, I just don't want to break it. It has a V8 engine, which presumably calls to other Ferraris, mastodons bellowing across the valleys, ideally in Modena, and it throws off the monstrous rain like a metal animal shaking its head. Down House is north of Sevenoaks. It was Charles Darwin's home. There is an intimacy to poking around dead men's houses. You are interviewing a ghost. My questions for this ghost: are you shy? He kept the manuscript of On the Origin of Species in a cupboard for 20 years. Nerds, though, go to his final work, The Formation of Vegetable Mould Through the Action of Worms. I can tell he loved his children. Of course he did. He loved beetles well enough. He built a sled for them to play on the stairs. There is also a letter to Karl Marx thanking him for sending a copy of Das Kapital. Marx was his own press officer, and he wouldn't have understood Darwin's very understated rudeness. I heartily wish that I was more worthy to receive it. Thank you for your letter, Mr. Marx, but evolution is slower than you think. Goodbye. Scotney Castle used to be owned by Christopher Hussey, the architectural editor of Country Life. This editor should live in a castle too. There is also a second castle in the garden for emphasis, but journalism is not what it was. The first castle is Tudor pastiche, and it is filled with photographs of cats, which Mrs. Hussey loved. The second is Scotney Old Castle, a round medieval tower with Tudor house and ruin attached. Lady Thatcher used to stay in the flat below the belfry in the new castle. I cannot imagine her enjoying the picturesque, but her husband styled himself Sir Dennis Thatcher of Scotney, so she must have liked it. There is an inscription in the stone. Upon this settled rock thy building surest stands, a way it quickly wears that resteth on its sands. Leeds Castle is Chalfont in the Ealing comedy Kind Hearts and Coronets. Louis Mazzini, the disinherited son of the daughter of the Duke and an opera singer, did the sixpenny tour before he killed his family for the house and title. I wonder if Louis, Dennis Price, would even want it now. It was ruined in the Victorian age and met with tarmac and lawns. It looks like a golf club because it is a golf club. We stay at the Pig at Bridge Place outside Canterbury. It is a red brick restoration mansion, very rare and beautiful, with pinkish carved brickwork. It used to be the Bridge County Club, a greasy cave that hosted the Kinks and Grabber Granny Nights, and was owned by Peter Malkin, a notorious man spiritually in search of a tabloid spread. Now there are silent rooms in greens with vast soft beds and William Morris Reds overlooking water meadows. It rains incessantly, which I love. I sit under canvas and look at the river as the sky drenches the land. The Ferrari, being a foreign celebrity, has many fans and is the natural predator of the Range Rover. They move aside for us. If they could look frightened, they would. There are dangers for us too, though. When I turn right, I am distracted by ramblers waving. I wave back like Tony Blair and put the wipers on. It is the Ferrari's own wave, and pull into the oncoming lane. I scream, but it is empty, and we both survive. Chartwell is a twee fortress on an escarpment with views, Winston Churchill's eagle's nest. It is filled with his concealments and the love people had for him. Children would send him cuddly toys, which he used for bookends. The most mesmerising gifts are from Joseph Stalin. They are gross. Two giant crystal sauce boats, one with a bear motif and one with a boat, looted from the Romanov cabinets. Was it deliberate? I think it was, but de Gaulle's gift was awful too, a crystal chicken by Lalique. It was a phony war with crystal, which everyone lost. In the studio is a Dr. Strangelove globe and a small self-portrait from 1915, in which Winston looks pale, shrivelled and unhappy. Churchill didn't admire his own paintings. The landscapes are primitive splodges, it is true, but this could be a sicket. But perhaps it frightened him, because he didn't paint another.
That was Tanya Gold. And finally, Rory Sutherland.
Among the horrors of lockdown, some aspects were bizarrely less gruelling than expected. Indeed, for some people, the experience was mildly positive. It's time to ask ourselves why. One possible explanation is JOMO, the joy of missing out. Much ostensibly voluntary human activity is not really voluntary at all. Like dressing for dinner in the 19th century, many elements of life are performative. They're things done to signal commitment or driven by social pressure. John Stuart Mill observed that society can and does execute its own mandates and practices a social tyranny more formidable than many kinds of political oppression. Since they're not usually upheld by such extreme penalties, it leaves fewer means of escape, enslaving the soul itself. And that's pretty much how I feel about commuting, singing happy birthday, cheek kissing and indoor drinks parties. Other unexpected positives of lockdown arose, I think, because a sudden shock to the system accelerated new uses of technology, which network effects and force of habit might otherwise have delayed for decades. Not just video calls, but also live online broadcasts of events like weddings, funerals, conferences and talks. During lockdown, I even watched a friend's son's bar mitzvah in Vancouver from a moving car. And trust me, nothing beats driving through an English town on a summer's day with Hebrew blaring through the open windows. Now, flying to such events is rarely easy or affordable, so the introduction of a third option between go and don't go is long overdue. It was theoretically possible to do this 10 years ago, we just didn't. Come to think of it, I'd buy far more theatre tickets if they said, if you can't be bothered to go to this, you can always watch it at home on telly. But there's another seemingly banal reason why some of us liked lockdown, I think. It was a break with routine. As a species, we crave variety, yet all models and business practices designed to improve economic efficiency leave our desire for variety out of the equation. In pursuit of a uniform average optimality, activity is divided into narrowly predefined repetitive tasks and targets with ever-decreasing scope for variation. Now, this reductionist approach may improve efficiency in theory, but at the hidden cost of removing any autonomy or initiative from our lives. Adam Smith died a virgin and lived with his mum, but even he thought that working in a pin factory must be pretty boring. Interestingly, most things that inject welcome variety into the pace of life, Christmas, Lent, Ramadan, the Sabbath, are actually the products of religion, not rationalism. Two problems often emerge from this reductionist approach. One is what I call open plan office syndrome, where you create an optimally efficient solution designed to work for everyone all the time, with the result that it works for nobody ever. Work requires a mix of sociability and solitude. The open plan office provides neither. The drive to focus on a single unvarying target forced GP surgeries to pursue only one objective, same-day appointments, disregarding the fact that some people, particularly those with jobs, prefer to book with a little advance notice. Often the best answer is a mixture of one thing and another, but such nuances cut no ice with the technocracy. We got Sundays wrong for the same reason, I think. Sundays are now just like any other day, except that as a sop to the God-botherers, your Waitrose closes at 4 p.m. Oh, the humanity. It would have been more interesting to keep one Sunday a month entirely commerce-free, leaving the rest normal. What about car-free days? I hated the idea 5 years ago. Now I'm really not quite so sure. Variety is good in and of itself. We live in West Kent, but have a small flat in East Kent. As I say to my wife, life, it's all about contrasts.
That was Rory Sutherland reading his Wiki Man column. Thanks for listening to this episode of Spectator Out Loud, and if you enjoyed it, pick up the issue to read more brilliant pieces like these. You can get 12 weeks of The Spectator for just £12 at spectator.co.uk/voucher. Thanks for listening, and join us again next week.